Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Gail Seiler, your host. We had some wild weather overnight. I know it woke me up. There was a combination of pouring rain, lightning, thunder, and then snow. And I think it sounded like there was some hail, but it's not too bad this morning. And some of our guests that are here drove up from Des Moines, and they said that they didn't get any snow down there. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from the Ames Progressive Alliance for their monthly segment. We'll be talking about the groups that emerged from the Inclusive Ames event that they sponsored last November and the work that these groups have been doing around diversity-related issues that were identified in the Ames community. We'll also be talking with a local newspaper editor about two very interesting stories that her newspapers published on trans students in rural towns in Iowa. But first, we're joined by some guests from ISU. Today we have with us Nikki Port, the Project Director for Diversity and Inclusion in LGBTQA+ Affairs. Thanks for being here, Nikki.
Thank you.
And we also have Taylor Shire, who is co-chair of LGBTQA+ Faculty and Staff Association. Thanks, Taylor.
Thank you.
And Joel Hochstein, who coordinates ISU's Pride Summit.
Good morning.
Thanks again. Nikki, let's start with you. The Office of Diversity and Inclusion, where your position is housed, is a new office. What's the overall mission of that office?
Well, in short, the mission of the office is to guide ISU's efforts in making or in enhancing an inclusive environment at Iowa State based on our stated values, like our strategic plan and other stated goals of the university.
So it has a very all-encompassing, wide goal.
Yep.
So your particular position then is also a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you carving out a role for yourself in that new position?
Well, the great part about my position is it's a generalist position, so I can impact depending on who wants to collaborate with our office. But for the portion of my job that is focused on LGBTQA matters, I really want to make Iowa State a destination for the LGBT community. Now, whether that's potential employees, potential students, their support staff or their support systems, or the alumni and visitors that love Iowa State. I really want to make it a destination for the LGBTQ community.
For listeners who might not be familiar with that series of letters, LGBTQA+, could you explain what that is?
Sure. So the initialism varies. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a set initialism across the country. But in general, most listeners might be familiar with LGBT,
mm-hmm.
and those letters stand for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. The QA can be seen differently in different areas. In some places, it stands for queer. In some places, it stands for questioning. In some places, it stands for other things. And then the A generally means ally, but can stand for asexual, aromantic, or anything else. Well, and some people even say all. Like A could stand for all. So mm-hmm. that would bring in allies and people who don't necessarily identify as a member of the population but are affirming of it.
And the plus, which is sometimes included, is again trying to get at that inclusivity idea?
Yes. At Iowa State, we added the plus to our LGBT Faculty Staff Association because we wanted to not leave people out even if a letter wasn't included in the initialism.
And so now we can bring in our other guests. So let's talk about how the LGBTQ community overall is organized on campus and how each of your positions fit in. So Taylor, are you going to start?
Yeah. So I, as co-chair of the FSA, the Faculty Staff Association exists to serve faculty and staff on campus and create an affirming community. We work really hard to have events where we can get together and talk about issues, social events, things of that nature. We also work a lot with Nikki in her role to make sure that faculty and staff are represented for the broader issues on campus. So we don't focus on students. We're mm-hmm. primarily there for faculty and staff. But we also do on campus have the LGBT Student Services Center. And I don't know, Joel, you can probably talk about that maybe more.
Sure, yeah. In my role, I help coordinate the Pride Summit. So the Pride Summit is a really interesting facet of the LGBT community because we don't really live anywhere. We don't live under the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. We don't live under the Dean of Students Office, which is where the Student Services is housed. We are kind of just out there. But what we do is we bring together all of the LGBT organizations that are on campus. So the Faculty Staff Association, our student services, our student leaders from our student groups. We bring those folks together and talk about issues that are affecting all of our community. So our faculty and our staff and our students, we get together. And that's what we do is we talk about what the issues are. If there's a current topic that we need to get together on to discuss, we do. At most of our meetings, we're talking about how we're going to organize our coming out week in the fall. And in the spring, it's mostly focused around events that we're having for Pride Week, which will be in April.
Nikki, how does your office then work with those other groups?
I'm an active member in Pride Summit, so I attend those meetings as well. I'm on the listserv. We keep in contact beyond our meetings to stay abreast on topics that we want to push forward. And then my office will coordinate. I'm not only a member, but my office also allows for when there's something bigger that the Pride Summit wants to do that's maybe more broad or bigger than any one organization, I can help out in any way we see. And we're still defining that, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And is there an can you give us an example maybe of something that these different organizations have worked together on to actually organize? That's something that's come out of this collaboration?
Sure. Nikki had worked with it the last year and a half or so. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, we've had lots of collaboration on our coming out week. So we have programs that our students will put together in collaboration with our staff members. So during coming out week in the fall, during Pride Week in the spring, that is a direct result of the collaboration that we do in Pride Summit. So I think it's a really unique aspect. We had just come back from a conference in Chicago and at that conference realized that, wow, we've got some pretty great things going on at Iowa State as compared to some of our other institutions in the Midwest. And so how do we capitalize on what those are and what the strengths are to continue to improve and enhance our climate?
And Pride Summit, I mean, for a little bit of history, it was born out of the Faculty Staff Association. So it came from the idea that we as faculty and staff, like one year we saw that we didn't know it was Pride Week until the Wednesday of Pride Week. So Pride Summit was really created to help with that communication so that the community could come together and support. Initially, it was about supporting student organizations in their programming, but it's grown to so much more where we talk about issues of being bold at every meeting. Like, what do we want to do beyond the programming that really built this group? How do we now want to see this group grow?
So what are your roles in terms of student rights and advocacy and activism? Do you get involved in that kind of political work?
Well, in terms of the Faculty Staff Association, because we don't work directly for the students or with the students, but we feel like anything that happens on the faculty and staff level definitely trickles down and impacts the students. So we actually released a statement yesterday on the rollback of the protection of transgender students being able to use the bathroom with which it works with their gender identity. And
could you explain just what happened? That was just yesterday.
Joel can actually speak more eloquently on this than I can, so I'm going to bounce this to him.
Finish your thought if you want, and then we'll go to him.
But I think that when we come forward as faculty and staff and say, you know, we as a campus are affirming and supportive of our community, that those things then are heard by the faculty and staff, and then they in turn can support the students through their daily work, because, you know, we're not separate from them at all. We work with students every day. It's the core of why we're there. But we do feel very strongly that as faculty and staff are supported on campus, then it really helps our students to know that they have a place. So we think that that's how we see our role in direct relation with the students on the FSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, regarding the statement that we put out yesterday, part of it was to reaffirm our commitment and our support to our transgender and gender nonconforming students, faculty, and staff at Iowa State. because oftentimes those folks aren't talked about.
Yeah.
Oftentimes those folks aren't considered. Oftentimes those folks at higher rates are victims of harassment and violence. And so we need there needs to be a bigger push.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that the rollback of protections by the current administration was a signal for us to – we need to be using our voice better and in a different way to signal to folks that this is an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not going to be any sort of federal enforcement or federal protection, that we need to rely currently on state protections. So those folks are currently protected by state regulations, the civil rights laws in Iowa protect on the basis of gender identity. So with the administration saying that this is a state's rights issue, which it's not, it's a human rights issue, and that affects everybody in every state in this country. But we have to rely on the state of Iowa's civil laws to protect our transgender folks. As a part of the end of that statement, though, was more of a call to action for faculty and staff members, offices, departments, and administrators to learn more and educate themselves more on the experiences of trans students in our educational environment, because most folks don't really have a good understanding. And I am still on my own educational journey of understanding the experiences of our transgender individuals. So it was a call to action. It was a couple of links to some best practices in higher education and ways that which we can protect our trans students without having to rely on Title IX as an example, which is what the rollback of guidance was from the current administration.
Yeah, if people are interested in reading the statement, it's actually currently posted on the VPDI's website at Iowa State.
It's at diversity.iastate.edu.
And we'll put a link to that when we post this show up on KHOI's website. What are you hearing about the experiences of trans students or other members of the LGBTQ community at ISU, especially in terms of the current political climate?
I've been hearing, at least, I work with students, and so and in my day job, as it were, and I think that we're hearing a lot of confusion. I think students are worried about kind of what the current administration, the policies that are being put forward, how that's going to impact them. But we are definitely working to make sure that everyone feels supported.
And this is. I would say there's fear and anxiety, but that's not new. That hasn't just
right.
happened in the last 48 hours. I mean, with all along with the election process and the cycle and then the election of the current administration, that has – our students have been feeling that for a while. And so while this is very specific and it's a cut, it's been a constant anxiety for our students and our faculty and staff who are wondering what is going to happen because Iowa State, very affirming of sexual orientation and gender identity, but what does it mean with a new administration? So this is not something that has just kind of popped up.
And I think, too, there's a difference in having protections rooted in state law or in local ordinance for sexual orientation and gender identity, there's a difference in having those protections and actually feeling affirmed and feeling wanted and feeling like you can exist. Literally, in some places, it's feeling affirmed to even exist in a space. That's much more difficult to educate folks on, to change folks' hearts, can sometimes be really difficult. So I think we're thankful that there are state and local protections. So if something does happen, that there's a process and a way to discuss those things. But I think in terms of changing the hearts and the minds of some folks to be better affirming in our daily lives and our daily interactions, to do things as simple as making sure that the forms that we use at the institution, when folks are asked to mark their gender identity, it's not just male and female. There's a whole spectrum, a whole host of ways in which folks identify their gender. There's a whole spectrum of ways in which folks identify their sexual orientation, their romantic orientation. And I think that we need to be thinking about those things, one, as an institution, but two, in our daily lives of what are we actually doing in terms of actions that show that we fully support folks in their existence.
And has progress been made? Have changes been made in those kinds of things like you mentioned, the checkoff boxes for gender identification on ISU forms and things like that?
You know, I think in some areas that there's been progress in some areas. I think there's been progress in staff members and in some folks who really care about the issue and really care about doing the right thing. We've got some workarounds, I think, to some some fairly antiquated systems at the university. We've got staff who've done some workarounds for folks, looking forward to our new enterprise system where maybe those things will be included and changed so that way we don't have to have these workarounds. But yes, I think that there has been some change. I think that there will continue to be change, and I think that our hope from a faculty staff perspective and from my place as the organizer of the Pride Summit, that we'll continue to use our voice to identify the areas that could use some continued growth and hope that folks will continue to make change.
And then utilizing the Office of Diversity and Inclusion to get at some of those maybe more systematic or those systematic things. Like if we're going to change our student information system, a vice president for diversity and inclusion might be at that table. And then by connection, I might be at that table. So we can find ways at Iowa State that maybe there are things that come through the Office of Diversity and Inclusion that others wouldn't know unless they were really paying attention. So we can, in our office, push that information out to maybe bring more people to the table, not just the leaders of our LGBTQ affirming groups, but our general population at Iowa State. So I'm really looking forward to that.
We have a couple minutes left, and one thing that's talked about a lot in the news that's related to this is the issue of bathroom access for trans students in particular. What's the big concern, and what's happening at ISU around that?
So because of state law, folks are allowed to use the restroom that they choose to in terms of how they identify. Their gender identity currently. Now we want to make sure that state law continues to protect folks on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. I really would hope that we would add gender expression to that, because oftentimes our folks are discriminated against not necessarily based on their gender identity, because I know someone's identity, but because I perceive them to be a certain way or I perceive them to be different based on their expression. So it's making sure we don't roll back, but also adding additional protections. So in terms of the bathroom piece, even though the guidance has been rolled back at the federal level, state law still protects folks from being able to use the bathroom in which they choose based on their how they identify their own gender.
And to go one step further, the LGBT Student Services Center has been working. They just rolled out their Trans at ISU guide, which talks about facilities use, housing, restrooms specifically in that guide. So it does give some language to conversations that took place between the center and other places on campus, because there was that collaboration that happened in putting this guide together. So there's language there that we can use really locally on a micro level instead of just interpreting that the state law covers us. There is guidance at Iowa State, and the LGBTSS is definitely the leader in that.
And are there any particular events coming up or issues coming up that you would want our listeners to know about? Wrap this up.
Well, I know that the LGBTSS, so the Student Services Center, is having Transgender Gender Nonconforming Night event at the center soon. So I know that that's happening.
Yeah.
We're working in Pride Summit on what our Pride Week events are going to be. So We'd love to come back closer to April to talk about
sounds,
our Pride
Summit
events.
Good. And those kinds of events are open to community members, not just ISU students?
The LGBTSS Center's events are typically students, but they do have language in their invitations that talk about anybody who's affirming. Mm-hmm. So faculty and staff are not excluded from that. Mm-hmm. But what you find is that that's kind of a place where students make community. And so you might choose not. But you're welcome to it.
But some of the Pride Week events?
Oh, yeah.
Pride Week events, we would love for community members to join in lots of those events.
Okay. That encompasses visitors, alumni, anybody who wants to show their support for the LGBT community. Okay. Also, there are some glimmers. These are not things that are set in stone, but some glimmers that your listeners might be interested in. There's a group of people who, and we've been a part of these discussions as well, who are interested in creating an Ames Pride. So if you're familiar with Pride festivals around the nation, those typically happen in June.
Right.
But in order for the town and the university to work together, we're talking about maybe having our first Ames Pride in the fall of 2017. So if there's any listeners that are interested in that, they can feel free to contact me and I can – at this point, it's just kind of conversations. There's no champions yet for that event. Mm-hmm. So if there's any champions out there, we would welcome
them. People can get involved in planning that. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for coming in, all of you, on this snowy morning. I've been speaking with Nikki Port, the Project Director for Diversity and Inclusion in LGBTQA plus Affairs at ISU, Taylor Shire, co-chair of the LGBTQA plus Faculty and Staff Association, and Joel Hochstein, coordinator of ISU's Pride Summit. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Recently, two local newspapers serving smaller towns around Iowa ran stories about transgender youth. One is in Nevada and the other is in Ballard. The headlines and the articles were front page stories in the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times, and they caught our eye. They didn't seem to be the usual kinds of stories that small town newspapers run. So we contacted the editor, Marlis Barker, who is also the journalist who wrote the stories, to talk with her about them. Also, one of the young people attends school in Nevada and received threats left on the high school's phone messages, and this seemed to be in response to the newspaper story. So in this interview, we'll hear Marlis Barker speaking about this and what happened after the stories were published. But I started the interview by asking her how she came to write these two stories.
Well, it started back this fall, actually. I follow Facebook and social media a lot just to look at what people are talking about and so to see where stories are. And I caught on to a particular post here in Nevada where there had been some questions because there was a transgender student in school and a mother was just asking, you know, what does this mean for her own kids, you know, that they're going to school with someone transgender and what does that mean with all the different things at school? And a number of people were commenting on it, and one local mother, Kathy Vincent, got involved in, she's part of a group of lay ministers here in town, Common Ground is their name, and they try to bring people together on various things in the community. And she was a little concerned about the lack of education that people might have when it comes to the entire LGBTQ community, including and specifically transgender students. So she asked the school and worked with the school to organize an event last fall, which was a community forum held at the high school here in town to talk about, and I'm talking about Nevada, to talk about this issue. And specifically, it reflected more on the transgender person than anything else about understanding what that is and you know, what the facts are, why someone is transgender. It was very educational. They invited in a lady from One Iowa, the organization in the state that helps with these kind of presentations. That was the Ms. Zapata that I quoted in my article. And so there was a pretty good turnout that night. And there was a transgender student from Gilbert, and he spoke at that forum and shared his personal story. And I was intrigued by that. And my first thought was, I need to find out a little bit more about his story. But as I was talking to him at the end, the Nevada student, Arthur Hansen, walked up by me. And I turned to him and said, "Are you a Nevada transgender student?" And he was very, very forthcoming and said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "Would you speak to me for our local paper?" And he said, "Yes, I would." And so that's kind of how it started, because I said I would like to do a follow-up, but I knew that I wasn't going to be able to put it together quickly because I wanted to talk to more than just Arthur. I wanted to talk to his mother, and she was also at the forum, Lori. I wanted to talk to, there was a doctor there, Allison Carlton, who treats the LGBTQ patients very specifically here in town. And so I knew that there were a number of people I wanted to talk to and reach out to for that story. So I knew it would take me a few months to get all of that together. The Ballard student, what happened was I have the newspapers that cover here Nevada and Colonesco, which is the Nevada Journal. And I also have the Tri-County Times, which covers Ballard, Collins Maxwell, and North Pope. I reached out to the Ballard principal, Don Ronca, to see if there might be a student, a transgender student, that I could speak to at Ballard, just to be able to provide a similar story in my other paper if I was going to go to all this work on an issue that I thought was really important for everybody. I wanted to have it be a little more local to my readers down in the Tri-County area. And it just so happened that Alex Glenn, a senior there who is a transgender student, was in the midst of putting together the group for Ballard called SAGA, which was sexuality and gender acceptance. And so John was very, you know, he said, "You couldn't be at a better time because we're just educating teachers and putting this group together, and I think Alex would love to talk to you." So he got myself and Alex hooked up, and that's how that story came about.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten to the articles?
Locally, the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. In fact, as you know, after the story ran, we had an incident of harassment toward the
right.
Baby. And I was in contact with the mother. She was in contact with me, letting me know about that. We became good friends throughout this process. And I felt terrible to think that something that I had run, you know, might have put this child in harm's way. Thankfully, they got this person and arrested him this past week. I spoke with Lori over the weekend, and we talked again. I have a follow-up story this week. But the first thing I wanted to know was, "Are you regretting that you talked to me about this?" And it was really interesting because she said, "No, I don't regret that at all, because these kids have to be not afraid to be who they are. If they can't be who they are and express themselves in the way that they want to express themselves, then we saw in the statistic what that could mean. Suicide, you know, pulling away from their families, you know, who knows." So I was pleased to know that they were still okay that they shared their story. And it should be okay for people to share their stories. What that person did in harassing them was completely wrong, completely wrong. The first threats came overnight, the night the story came out in our paper. So, you know, that's a sad thing. However, the thing that Lori said to me was that overwhelmingly they have been surrounded with love and such. And that's, you know, so many positive comments of support coming for them, for what their child has gone through and is experiencing. And she said that is just amazing to their family. She also shared with me, you know, that she had run into someone locally in town when she was out and about who shared a personal story with her about their child. And she said, you know, their fears about coming out because that child was gay. And so, you know, people reach out. And I have a friend who used to live in town who still gets the Nevada Journal, who texted me when she got the paper about a week, you know, she's about a week behind because she's out of state, and said, "Oh, what a great story," because she said, "If we had been this open to people who are different back when my child was in school, his life would have been so much different." She had a gay son, is what she said. And he never felt right and he never felt he could be who he was here in Nevada. So I think that's really sad to know that he struggled and did not have the kind of childhood and growing up experience that every mom wants for their kids. That kind of hit me too.
Yeah, those are very powerful reactions to your story. And was it up on your websites too for the local papers?
Yes, we post everything to the web, and then we also post a lot of our stories to our Facebook pages.
To even get more widespread coverage.
Yes, I also post on my personal page. In a small town, we don't often get the chance to tell stories that are that amazing or that politically, you know, I don't know if I want to say politically, but that sensitive to the public. And I felt like as a journalist, it was like a big moment for me. So I shared it personally. Had a lot of my relatives and high school friends saying, wow, you know, good for you, way to put this out there. And even people that I thought might react to the story by rolling their eyes or not thinking it was something I should have done told me that it was professionally done and they appreciated hearing the story. I really, you know, was amazed at a lot of the reactions.
Well, it caught our eye in the big town of Ames.
Yeah.
and we were impressed and glad to see it out there as well. And we'll look for the follow-up story this week. That's good to know. There's more to come.
We will have a follow-up story this week with Arthur's mother and a few comments. Yeah, I'm glad it all worked out. I'm glad that the local people, the local officials reacted to those threats very quickly. And like Arthur's mother said, maybe this will push just a little harder for the transgender classification of people to be a protected class when it comes to hate crimes. Because right now, they are not. And that is why Mondel Olson cannot be charged with a hate crime.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Marlis Barker, the editor of the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times, and also the author of two recent stories on trans students in Nevada and Ballard. And now we turn to our monthly visit from Ames Progressive Alliance. Ann Kinzel has joined us, and she brought a guest, and I will be switching hats now, because I am going to be one of the people that Ann interviews today, as I'm involved in one of the groups she'll be talking about. So, Ann, I'm going to give my producer host hat to you, and I'm going to put on the interviewee hat here.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Gail. Welcome, Cheryl Benson, Gail Seiler. Great to have you. For those in the community, Cheryl is a longtime community, I would say, activist. Is that true, Cheryl?
I tend to be active, yes.
You do. And Gail is a KHOI producer and teaches in the School of Education at Iowa State. Well, I'm so glad to have both of you here this morning to tell us about your experiences in building community as an outgrowth of the recent Ames Progressive Alliance Inclusive Ames event. For our listeners, a brief recap. On November 29th last year, the APA sponsored Inclusive Ames, A Time to Act. The event was co-sponsored by the Ames Public Library and the Ames Human Relations Commission, and it focused on bringing people together in small group discussions. The goal was to foster a sense of community inclusiveness around progressive goals after our recent polarizing national election. So let's talk a little bit about your experiences with Inclusive Ames and what happened afterwards. So, Cheryl, you've been active in a number of community and political efforts over the years. What drew you to attending Inclusive Ames last fall?
The word that you use, polarizing, was the primary thing. The languaging during the campaign and then from our current administration is hostile and separatist. And if that continues to generate the fear and the anger that's going on, we're going to have a very divisive community. And I don't want that for Ames. I don't think any of us want that for Ames. So the word inclusive right off the bat drew me to the event last November.
Yeah, inclusive is a word that we're hearing a lot these days. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience at the event? What did you do at Inclusive Ames? What did you learn?
Well, first of all, when you walked into the room, it was set up with small group chairs. And so you were very much encouraged, very strongly encouraged to sit with people you didn't know, which was great because if you sit with people you know, you're just sort of proverbial singing to the choir, which is fun but not informative. The other thing that was really helpful in terms of the organization was that there was post-it notes that within each small circle. So anything that anyone said that could be actionable was written on that post-it note and then shared with the whole group. I thought it was very effective. So Jess Calhoun took all of those post-it notes, bless her heart, what a service, and again, very inclusive because everybody's ideas were jotted down, they were talked about, they were included, and from that then came what's now Inclusive Aims and the Actions.
I would just add that it was one of the most diverse groups, racially, ethnically, from what I could tell, religiously, that I've seen in Ames. I was impressed by that. And it really brought out many, many different types of people.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Gail. And along with that, lots of young people, which, you know, for those of you who can't see me on the radio, I'm a gray hair. And it was great to see a wide diversity of age as well. So good point. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, that's been a hallmark of Inclusive Ames and the Ames Progressive Alliance. I was there that evening, but I had childcare duty. And we do that at all our events so that younger people with families can bring and participate, which is something that we don't always do in communities. So that was important. Cheryl, at the conclusion of the event, I know that the APA called for people to join action teams. And we know that you joined an action team. What made you decide to take that next step?
Well, the name Inclusive Aims indicated to me that there was going to be some action, and I went expecting there to be more than just chit-chat, and I've not been disappointed. There's definitely been action that's come out of that. Again, I think that had a lot to do with the way it was organized and then the follow-up with all of the action items that were sent out.
Which team did you decide to join?
I joined the one that was identified as question one, which had to do how do we address threats and advocate for unique needs of refugees, LGBTQ individuals, people of color, targeted faiths, and immigrants? That was the way the question was phrased. And the reason I chose that was, well, two reasons. I don't really know what the needs are, and so I can't be much of an advocate. But mostly it was because those are the groups of people to whom the fear and the anger is being directed right now. And just unnecessarily so. There's nothing to fear. There's no reason to be angry. So how can we diffuse that and get some rational, less emotional interactions going on within our community?
Well, earlier you mentioned the word inclusive. It sounds like your team is including a lot of the differences identified in society.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about your team. How many people are there?
Well, out of the question one team, we have three more teams. It's a very broad opportunity to do different things. So the team that I'm working with, we're calling ourselves Sanctuary Community, and there's 16 of us right now that meet. We meet every other week for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and then there's sub-meetings, if you will, or email chats, however we communicate in between that so that we keep the action moving forward.
Now, you mentioned that the sanctuary group, are you working with other people in the community or is this just a focus team?
Oh, no. We're absolutely co-working with whatever teams that are interested in the types of things that we're doing as well. And again, that's one of the really hopeful and helpful things that are going on in our community. There are so many different groups and people that really want to have a community that isn't divisive, that is inclusive, whatever language you use to express those values. So we are working with other teams.
And how do you find people to work with?
Oh, my goodness, not a problem.
Again,
there's so many activities going on. We've mentioned Pints and Postcards, and there's a group out of the college, Ames for Change. And then, of course, there's all of the Inclusive Ames groups. There's Ames Progressive Alliance. So Human Relations Commission, a person doesn't have to try hard to be plugged in. Talk to somebody at the coffee shop and see what's going on.
How do you get new members, though? Do you actually solicit people in the community? Do you contact them, or do they just sort of organically show up?
Well, sometimes it's organically because they know somebody who's involved type of thing. The Inclusive Ames has a website, inclusiveames.org, super easy to remember. And on the homepage, there's a button that says Get Involved. Person just clicks on that button, fills out the form, and then they'll be contact. It indicates interest, and it may be interest of one of the groups that are Inclusive Ames, or it may just say, hey, I want to get involved. And somebody will contact you and make the connections.
So within your group, is this a group that's rather flat hierarchically, or do you have some sort of organizational structure? How's it work?
Well, in our particular group, Mary Wheelock and I are the co-chairs, but just to facilitate the meeting. And then the people that are on our team of the 16 have somewhat different interests, similar, of course, because we're on the same group. And then those people would be, I guess, you could call them the point people for the initiatives that are coming out of our particular action team.
Now, when we started the Ames Progressive Alliance, one of the things that we were interested in was sort of bringing back a sense of civic action or civic duty to participate in the community. But we had a sense that many people had sort of lost connection with that. In your experience, is it hard? Is it easy to be involved like this? How would you describe it if somebody brand new?
If somebody brand new has an inkling of interest in being engaged in the community, it's super easy because there's so much going on. And I would say if somebody has that inkling, they're ready and they're prepared because that's all it takes. It takes an interest, a passion, if you will, about a particular issue, and a commitment to do something with that passion.
So about how much time do you find yourself devoting to this kind of activity?
Too much.
Thank you, Gail. I wouldn't necessarily say too much, but definitely a lot. It's definitely a lot. And because there's so much going on right now in the political arena with our both the state and the federal, and it's happening fast. So we can't, I don't feel that I won't speak for everybody, but I don't feel that I can sit back and say, this too shall pass. It won't pass, at least not the way that I would like to see it pass in terms of, again, having a community that is inclusive. And I'm going to keep staying with that word.
Well, it's a big word. It's an important word. And really, Cheryl, you epitomize, I think, for our listeners what it means to, you know, act local. And we really thank you for that kind of service to our community because it is important. And your experience is something I think that many people in the community can relate to.
Well, thank you for that. And I will say it's easy because there's so many people that are involved. It's not a solo effort. This is a team effort.
So it's fair to say that your goals are inclusive, but your work style as a team is also very inclusive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well put. Thank you.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. So right now we're going to turn a little bit to our other guest, Gail Seiler, who can tell us about her experience being active in the community through the vehicle of Inclusive Ames. So, Gail, I understand your work at ISU includes working with future teachers on issues related to teaching and multicultural education. Is that right?
That's correct. That's what I teach at ISU.
How long have you been doing that?
This is just my third year at ISU, but I've taught elsewhere.
Is it your professional interest that drew you to the Inclusive Ames that Cheryl described for us, or was it something more?
Well, my research in education has always been focused around equity in education, and in particular that students of all backgrounds, races, ethnicities, languages, and so on would have equitable opportunities to learn in school. So that's been my focus. And I've always had kind of a fuzzy boundary between my actual research and community work and involvement. But I've never really been involved to the extent that I am now involved with this work coming out of the Inclusive Ames group. So it's what drew me to it, but I am in some ways actually surprised at how much I've gotten involved.
Well, a lot of the Ames Progressive Alliance activity has involved sort of a kind of an educational bent about civic participation. As an educator, I'm curious as to what you thought about the original Inclusive Ames event held in November as a vehicle. What did you think about that?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was well organized. The format that Cheryl described with the small tables, encouraging people to sit with people they didn't know, the sticky notes and giving us stickers with our names on them to put on the groups that we wanted to be a part of at the end. It worked very well. And it wasn't information heavy from just like presenters. There was none of that. It was all information and learning from other people who were there. So I thought it was a really welcoming, informative format.
Well, good. That's good to know. I'm sure the organizers can take some notes from people with experience in education such as yourself. So that's helpful to know. Like Cheryl, you decided to continue your participation beyond Inclusive Ames and join an action team. Which team are you part of?
I joined what was question number 2 on that day, which was similar to what Cheryl described, but it was focused on young people. So it was particularly asking what can we do in the Ames community to make it a safe, welcoming, inclusive place for young people.
So about how many people are part of your team?
Well, our team now, I would say, has about 30 active members. And what happened in our group was when we started meeting, initially the focus was on youth more broadly. But because of things that came up in the discussions and some things that happened in the news, we ended up focusing on schools. So we ended up focusing on racial disparities in education in the Ames schools. So it shifted a little bit, and that's where we are now, working on that.
That sounds very topical. We've seen some things about that in the newspaper, both nationally mm-hmm. and more locally. Can you tell us a little bit about the group's involvement with the Ames schools and what you see yourself doing in the future?
Well, what we've been trying to do is we gathered information and so things we've done so far. We're trying to work very fast because we think it is we want to be timely. We think it is an issue that we can get some attention to right now. So we produced a fact sheet that shows various racial disparities, including not just achievement but in other areas as well. And we've been meeting with school board members and sharing that with them, and we're going to have people speaking at the next school board meeting. And we've already gotten a positive, concerned response from the school board members that we've met with. And we've offered suggestions as to, not that we're telling them what to do, but we had some suggestions of what we thought might work to help them get more of a gauge of how the community is feeling about these kinds of disparities.
Wow. So you said you had about 30 people in your group. So for our listeners, I'm curious. Obviously, I don't think you all go as a group of 30 and meet with school board members. How does that work?
Well, a couple of us have kind of taken the lead on that. And yeah, it's kind of, in some ways, it's who's available at different times. And so it's just trying to meet people, what people want to do, how they want to be involved, when they're available, whether they go to the school board meeting, they come to other meetings, they meet with school board members. Some people are writing letters. And so there's many opportunities for people to participate in different ways and depending on their schedule.
Well, that's great. It sounds like both of you are definitely helping push our community towards a more progressive future, and we really appreciate that. I just want to ask Cheryl, what exactly is your group focusing on, say, in the next 3 months? Do you have any upcoming events, anything that community members might be interested in learning about or participating in?
One of the first things that we hope everybody sees very soon is a sign that we're creating that talks about it. It's basically a sign that we hope people will put in their homes that says Inclusive Ames, you're welcome here. And we're mirroring the design, if you will, that you've probably already seen in businesses that are showing up here in Ames. So that's a really straightforward action that's happening, and people can help distribute those, help by having them in their own homes. The poster, whatever it is, poster, yard sign, bumper sticker, is intended to say, I believe it's a value of an inclusive Ames. It's not a statement about anything else other than that. So that's happening right now. In addition to that, our team is broken into three teams, and they're all intertwining and they're all working together. And one is sort of a needs assessment, what's currently available now in terms of meeting needs and how can they be accessed, how can they be communicated so people know they're available. And also we're gathering input about what does it mean to be a sanctuary community, a safe community. And we're talking to the people who possibly, quite probably, actually don't feel particularly safe right now. We want to find out what we can do as a community to shift that feeling of not safe. And then we're also talking about diversity training, bystander training, and diversity bias training, you know, sort of a walk a mile in my moccasins kind of training, whatever style moccasin somebody chooses to wear. So those are the things that will be coming out into the community very shortly, we hope.
Well, that's an impressive list. Very, very well done. And Gail, I'll ask you the same question. What is your team focusing on for the next 2-3 months?
Well, right now we're focused on raising attention, as I described about this. So it kind of depends on what happens, you know, what kind of response we get in these initial actions that we're taking. So that it depends, but we're looking for more people to be involved. And so, if people are interested, they should go to the Inclusive Ames website that Cheryl mentioned and let us know they want to get involved.
Perfect. Well, there's an old expression about people being all hat and no cattle. I could say that these two groups sound like there's a lot of cattle. That's great. Yes, Cheryl.
If I could interject, too, I've been asked, it's like, okay, so what happens after these things are done? And my thinking is that Inclusive Ames is intended to be an ongoing group of volunteers that are interested in Ames. And so these issues may pass in terms of the signs are all up, we don't need any more signs, or the school board is to approve the resolution, whatever. But there will be new things coming up in our community. Mm-hmm. So this isn't a, you know, we're here for the next couple, 3 months kind of thing. So just wanted to interject that we're here to stay.
It certainly sounds like you are. There's a lot of issues and a lot of energy. Well, that's great. I want to thank both Cheryl and Gail for joining me this morning and sharing their experiences and helping build a more progressive Ames community. I hope our listeners will be sure and keep up with APA activities on the Ames Progressive Alliance Facebook and the Ames Progressive Alliance website at www.amesprogressivealliance.org. You can get a copy of this radio show and follow the latest developments, such as the Ames Community Solar Initiative, on the Facebook page and website. A quick plug for some upcoming events. There will be a Femi Fest by Maximum Ames Music Festival, February 26th, from 2 to 9 p.m. And you can get information on that at the Vinyl Grind or the Morning Bell Coffee Roasters. And as always, I'd like to thank KHOI for hosting this show. KHOI is doing so much to move our community towards a more progressive future.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I'm your host and interviewee today, Gail Seiler. Thanks to our guests earlier in the show, we spoke with Nikki Port, Taylor Shire, and Joel Hochstein, who work with and support LGBTQ initiatives at ISU. We also heard from Marlis Barker, who is the editor of the Nevada Journal and the Tri-County Times. And lastly, thanks to Ann Kinzel for the monthly update from Ames Progressive Alliance and to her guest, Cheryl Benson. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered today by Ursula Rudenberg. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as an audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater. Presenting The Importance of Being Earnest, a Trivial Comedy for Serious People, a Satire by Oscar Wilde. February 24th through March 5th at Fisher Theater in Ames. Tickets and more information can be found at theater.iastate.edu.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the award-winning National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu. Center.iastate.edu.